Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis, and this is Music Weekly from The Guardian. In today's show, sci-fi-influenced R&B singer Janelle Monáe tells us how a theatrical background helped shape her music career and what it's like working with Sean Diddy Queen.
I mean, I think that he believed strongly in what we were doing, and I don't think it was for political reasons. Off the record, I've talked to him, and I've seen him listen to the music that we created, and I've seen how he's reacted.
Singles Club this week features Rihanna, Tame Impala, and Jim Sullivan. And the feature with No Name is back. This time, we'll be remembering Washington punk, or I suppose post-punk band, Fugazi. Rosie Swash is here.
Hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm very well, how are you?
I'm not too bad. What's all this I hear about JLS and their condoms?
Myself and producer Pete were doing a bit of non-music related content for a new series of Guardian podcasts that are going to be out soon called Focus. And we were doing it about...
Focus on condoms.
Yeah, focus on...
focus
big
on
market.
We went to
Brook Clinic as part of a discussion about STIs in teenagers, and the woman said, by the way, JLS turning up later. So I just can't get away from
music. Because they're responsible for a lot of STIs in teenagers.
They're launching their own condoms.
Wow. Has it got a crazy name?
No, I don't think it's got a crazy name, but it's got a picture of each of them on different packets.
Wow.
So you can pick.
Are they different sizes?
Don't know.
Well, that sounds amazing.
Sounds
like the best day out ever, really.
That's pretty good.
A big welcome back to Ben Beaumont-Thomas.
Hello.
Ben. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thanks.
Excellent. Now, we're going to start off with something you've done, which is an interview with Janelle Monáe. The R&B singer was signed by Sean Combs' Bad Boy Records and released her second album, The Arch Android, back in May. Like a first record, which I think was an EP, am I right in saying it?
Indeed, yeah.
It's a concept album based around the character Cindy Mayweather, features a huge array of musical influences, which we'll be discussing shortly. We'll hear how you got on with you. Was Janelle nice?
She's very, very nice.
Really?
Truly fabulous in every way.
Wow. Okay, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, we will hear about her true fabulousness in every way. After we hear a track from the album, this is Cold War. So you think I'm alone?
Understand that you started in more of a theatrical background. Is that the case? And then you sort of moved on to a more kind of straight ahead, ordinary, I guess you'd say, musical career. Why did you sort of move away from the theatre towards music?
I don't believe that I've moved away from either or. I've created a world where both of them can breathe and live. Musical theatre, music. Art inspires art to me, and there's no, I don't have to do either or, so I combine them. I just create and write my own musicals versus portraying a character that has been created and, you know, people have been that character over and over and over again. I choose to write and be in control of the production.
I wrote a blog on The Guardian about your record, and in the comments section, some people were quite surprised that that Sean would be maybe working with an artist that's quite outside of the sort of traditional rap and hip-hop world. I mean, do you think he gets enough credit for being, you know, taking chances?
I believe that you meet people at certain points and times of their lives where they're ready to support something that they believe in. I mean, I think that he believed strongly in what we were doing, and I don't think it was for political reasons. I, off the record, I've talked to him, and I've seen him listen to the music that we've created, and I've seen how he's reacted. So I think that he just genuinely, it was an organic thing for him. I don't limit what people can do and what kind of musical taste they like. I don't find it strange. I think he's into big concepts and ideas, and so were we, so it worked out. Again, we creatively are in control, and he's a huge, you know, an endorser of the Wonderland Art Society, and he just wanted people and wants people to know about what's going on, you know.
Something that I find really fascinating about your record and about, well, the entire suite of records that you're bringing out is that there's a real kind of obviously the Metropolis image is, you know, very resonant of classic science fiction. But then there's a, it's sort of similar in the way to Andre 3000 or Big Boy, or even going back further to Herbie Hancock or Sun Ra or George Clinton. All these kinds of people have a real sort of fixation on outer space and the intergalactic.
Well, the people that I hang out with, we like science fiction, but I didn't grow up, my family didn't grow up feeding me science fiction books and films and things like that. So there is a level of Afrofuturism that is in the world of Metropolis and the Archandroid, something that I am into. But again, I can't speak for everyone else, but I don't limit myself to any of the stereotypes that us as Black people may have.
There's, you know, bands like Dirty Projectors borrowing stuff from US R&B, a kind of white art school band doing things like that. Them collaborating with Solange Knowles, you obviously collaborating with Of Montreal. Do you think there's a kind of increasing sort of fluidity in American music at the moment that maybe there wasn't before?
Sure. I think that people are coming together, and that's a great thing. I'm really excited about it, and I'm happy to be involved in that movement of uniting. There are far too many things and people that keep us segregated. You know, oh, that you can't do that. That's for those people, or those people have been known to do that. You should stick with that. That people will understand that more. I think that it's very important that we, again, erase those divisive lines and get rid of those divisive tactics and do the things that make us feel good. You know, I don't get into the politics of collaborating with artists just because of X, Y, and Z. I'm either a huge supporter or fan of their music, and I'm genuinely moved by that music, and likewise. And that's the reason why I collaborate, you know, not for the sake of being different or, for politics, but it's because it feels good. I'm worried about my catalog, and when my children or generations look at the music that we've created, they can look and say, that was really a great song.
That was Janelle Monáe talking with Ben. She's an interesting woman, isn't she? It's kind of intriguing, I think, this record. Seems to be the big kind of R&B crossover success of this year. I noticed at the end of this year she's supporting Vampire Weekend. She's a really interesting sounding gig, I think. It's an interesting person for Vampire Weekend to have supporting them, and they're an interesting band for her to pick to support. Why do you think, Ben, that it's crossed over in the way that it has, like, beyond the parameters of a normal R&B?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I thought I put it to her that, you know, the Afrofuturism thing that she was doing with the Metropolis and all these different imagery that she was using was, you know, perhaps a part of this lineage of, like I said, Sun Ra and Herbie Hancock and so on moving forward. And she slightly dismantled that rather cute little theory with this, like, multiplicity of her sort of creative vision. And I kind of realised, actually, yeah, she has got a very singular vision that incorporates a lot of different things, like you say, but also draws on the past, draws on the present, draws across genres. And, you know, I think that's perhaps, you know, the influence of the internet. Perhaps we're moving away from black music in inverted commas. Like, you know, we have the BET Awards or the MOBO Awards where people strongly identify as black. Yeah. But then you have maybe someone like Janelle Monáe, who taps very much into that heritage and is, you know, identifies herself in that way, but also is a bit more broadly sort of pan-ethnic, maybe. And maybe that's, you know, the internet allowing all those influences to filter down. Or
it's an interesting idea, isn't it? It's certainly an interesting idea that people are more, I think also the audiences are more, perhaps a bit more open-minded now in the way that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even, I remember I was working on an indie magazine about 10 years ago, 2000, when literally, I mean, the only interesting music that was around was R&B. You know, you were getting this, you know, the big kind of little, it was like terrible music like Limp Bizkit and things like that were big. And then you get these amazing records that kept appearing, like Try Again by Aaliyah and stuff like that. And, you know, we tried putting that in the magazine on the grounds that you'd go, hey, kids, you know, this is We Need a Resolution by Aaliyah is intrinsically better than... I can't remember who the big, the hotly tipped indie bands, they were like JJ72. King Adora. Do you remember King Adora? Amazing band.
Just when the landfill was beginning to fill up with the indie, I guess.
I suppose it was like the arse end of Britpop. You know, it was just before the Strokes and just before the White Strokes. We tried putting these people in the magazine, and the kids were not having it at all. I mean, they were really.
I used to love that classic era that was massively unsuccessful of the NME when they had Destiny's Child
on the cover.
They sold 10 or 13 copies, I believe, or something. Absolutely outrageously.
But then all the, generationally speaking, all the people that actually grew up and didn't have prejudged notions of what that music is are now in bands and making music, like we were talking about XX.
Absolutely.
How adapted they are to R&B culture and how natural it is to them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, you know, it's not the weirdest thing you could imagine, but it's still... judging by what you were saying.
Oh, no, I mean, I think there's definitely been a change in attitude in that it was something that, you know, like I said, as a music lover, I thought it was really obvious that this was the most interesting music around at the time. But didn't seem, you know, music was still being very defined in those generic terms. But I think also the nature of indie music has changed pretty dramatically, or the nature of alternative music has changed pretty dramatically in those 10 years. I noticed, Ben, that you couched a question quite politely there, which you were basically saying to a... I'm quite surprised, and other people are surprised, that you're working with Diddy, because Diddy essentially gives every impression of being a bit of a plank.
I'm a big Diddy flag wave.
Oh, are you really? Yeah, really Ciroc Nation, let's go!
Got big love for the Diddy,
Wow, okay, sorry.
Pour Cristal over myself in, yeah.
Do you?
Yeah.
It's all about, so I follow him on Twitter. Absolutely.
That's pretty powerful stuff, Twitter. Actually. Yeah.
Let's go, Ciroc! You can do whatever you want to. Who's with me, people?
God has blessed this day.
10 exclamation marks.
Yeah, 15 million exclamation marks. Please retweet.
Got to fill out those 140 characters with exclamation marks. But no, I
do you think it's a weird thing? I mean, because he seems to be trying to broaden out a bit at the moment. He's got kind of...
But I think it's something he's done for a while. Like he made fairly famously, I remember reading in Music magazine, Music with a K, anyone remember that?
I do.
Back in the day, and a report from the Miami Winter Music Conference where they said in awestruck tones that they saw Diddy basically flying off his face on pharmaceuticals, holding two bottles of champagne. Screaming, Jack Music all night long! Jack Music all night long! It's like seen, and it's this record he made with Felix de Hauskas back in the middle part of the last decade, which was not all brilliant. Actually, most of it was complete tripe. There were a couple of really interesting songs, but the very fact that he was doing that, I mean, a long, long time before, you know, before Will.i.am would go to Ibiza or, you know, or Pharrell with Swedish House Mafia or anything like that. He was doing that a lot further, you know, before in time.
I've heard he used to turn up, he did turn up in the Miami conference, and he had his own little rave bag. Do you remember those mini Nike rucksacks?
Oh, yeah.
It was like a horn and a whistle.
Wow. That's amazing. Diddy, the well-prepared raver. I know he went to Ibiza with Lady Victoria Hervey, the well-known raver.
God, that's a yacht. Night to behold.
Imagine being in a club, like really mullet. P. Diddy's there with Lady Victoria. You'd be like, I'm not taking these again.
One of my friends once actually said he told me he'd seen Kofi Annan in a club. At the time that he was actually UN Secretary General, which we're thinking, I don't know if he's going to take time out of his, you know, his peacekeeping duties to spend time at a breakbeat night in Sheffield. But hey, I could be wrong. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point at which to end the discussion about Janelle Monáe. The Arch Android, if you haven't got it already, and I assume a lot of people listening to this already have, because it does seem to be the big sort of breakout album of the year, and it does seem to have more ideas over the course of its 70 minutes or whatever than most artists produce in a lifetime. So if you haven't got it, definitely check it out. The Arch Android by Janelle Monáe is out now. Time for Singles Club now. We've each brought in a track to discuss, and this one was chosen by Ben.
Like I'm the only one that you'll ever love. Like I'm the only one who knows your heart. Only
Wow. Jack music all night long. There you go. That's Rihanna's new single, The Only Girl in the World. That's absolutely remarkable. And that sounds like it might have been released by on the record label All Around the World.
Yes. Home of Perfecto, perhaps.
Perfecto, yeah. It's she's really, they've really gone full
gone, yeah,
on.
All everything into the red with this one, I think. Yeah, but I actually, it's interesting, kind of follows off from what we're talking about before in many ways, because in the noughties you'd have these crazy sonic canvases that female R&B singers were allowed to kind of navigate across. And now, and then, you know, even further back, you'd have someone like Loretta Holloway or Jocelyn Brown, who'd just get to have this like free-form, emotional, warbly freak out over a record. And now this seems a little bit more defined, structured around the kind of architecture of a classic club track. You know, you've got the very front-loaded with the chorus, which is huge and brilliant and fantastic melody that stayed in my head for all week. And, you know, and then it sort of builds to a classic 4/4 drop, hands in the air moment. And, you know, I think it's encouraging that Americans are accepting these kind of club cultural sounds into mainstream work.
I don't think you can underestimate how much of a divide there once existed between the kind of hip-hop and R&B scenes in the house and sort of dance music in America, because dance music was just, you know, there's no getting around this. It was considered just music for gays. You know, that was absolutely...
I remember I used to live in America in 2004, and even at that point when, you know, we'd had 10 years or so of the internet, people really thought that cutting-edge European dance music, mainstream college kids who you think would be quite switched on, thought that Ace of Base was pretty damn cutting-edge.
Wow, really?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Drop the sign next to, like, Lil Jon, people would go mental. And,
fantastic.
You know, and now, you know, I think people are, you know, that stuff is, you know, genuinely good quality, funky house music has become, you know, the biggest pop music in America
I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, the only criticism I've got of it as a record, or I suppose it's not a criticism of it as a record, but as a sort of, as in the way that the R&B has moved, is that going back to that kind of period of R&B we were talking about before in 2000, you would get these records that would appear like Oops, Oh My by Tweet and stuff like that, and you would just be like, this is from Mars. I have absolutely, I can get no purchase on what these people have been listening to, what they're trying to do, to all that kind of thing. And it seems to be very, very far apart from the kind of pop music that's been produced in Britain, whereas it actually seems to be becoming slightly more homogenised. And although it's a better song record than a sort of Girls Aloud record would be, you know what I mean, you could imagine this being done by somebody like Girls Aloud. That's not a criticism of them. The world knows I'm a huge Girls Aloud fan, but Rosie, anyway, that's
no,
my view,
I agree. I agree completely. On the one hand, I have a real sort of bottomless appetite for this kind of ultra cheesy tops off in Mallorcan nightclub music.
I know you do.
But wow. But my other issue with it, other than what you mentioned about the regression of R&B in a sense, is that I think one of Rihanna's biggest problems is that she's moving far too much between different genres to have really carved her own niche. Mm. And she did it a bit on the, what was the record prior to Rated R, where she had to Shut Up and Drive, and it was
Good
all,
Girl Gone Bad.
Good Girl Gone Bad, and she was kind of all over the place. And she said of that record at the time, this is, I mean, who knows how much of it is her inspiration, but she said at the time, I'm trying a little bit of everything out. And when I hear her do something like this, for one, it doesn't actually sound like her. If I didn't know it was Rihanna, I really don't think that I would guess it was her singing-wise. And I think that's because she's been super auto-tuned, which is a bit of a shame. Because actually, when left in her own range, she's got a really distinctive
voice. She's got an incredibly distinctive voice.
Exactly.
And quite a good voice. It's sort of icy and detached. And you know, the opposite of what an R&B, you know, the absolute opposite of what Loretta Holloway or
anyone
talking about. You know, the way they would sing.
And so that side of it is gone, and it leaves it a bit more about the song than it is about her, and I think that's a bit of a shame, but I did really enjoy it.
It's a great pop record, I think. Our Only Girl in the World by Rihanna is out in the US this week. We're not actually sure of the UK release date, but it's all over the internet, so I'm go and nick it from somewhere. Let's have a listen to Rosie's choice. That was Why Won't You Make Up Your Mind by Tame Impala. Rosa, your choice.
Yes, I brought this in for various reasons. A lot of my friends were saying, oh, and I really like Tame Impala. Do you like Tame
Impala?
It's
a big buzz. The buzz about Tame Impala.
And they've got a new single out, which isn't this one, called Lucidity, I think, which just sounds so much like the Beatles. I just think, why would a band in 2010 still be trying to sound like the Beatles? And there was a lot of the record when we listened to it. I was on holiday recently, and it was one of the few actual CDs. Everyone neglected to bring any hard copy music, and it was one of the few that we had. And this was the song that really leapt out of me. I think it's absolutely stunning song.
But was this when you were in Ibiza?
This is when I was in Ibiza. I'm not sure what people are hearing in them, like where the buzz is coming from, other than the fact that they're Australian and it's...
I don't know, that's why the buzz is. Are people just desperate for a new, hot new Australian band? Yeah, okay, so other than the Australian angle,
I don't know, I'm putting it out to the listeners, putting it out to the panel.
I think it sort of fills a slightly MGMT-shaped hole. I think people like that kind of, you know, I think... People have a liking for psychedelia, don't they? And music that's sort of kind of knowingly psychedelic. You've only got to look at the way the Flaming Lips, you know, who were the best. I mean, I love the Flaming Lips, but, you know, they've been touring essentially the same show now for about 12 years around. And they go and headline at Green Man, or they go and headline at Bestival, and everyone goes absolutely fucking mental, you know. People just like that kind of thing, and I think this fits in with it. I do think it's a good album, Tame Impala album. Ben, are you a
fan? Yeah, I think it does tick those kind of, MGMT boxes, and I also think it does the sort of do you guys know DuckTales and those sorts of bands that kind of really sound like a worn out cassette player?
Oh, like Aerial Pink.
Yeah, similar. Yeah. And the DuckTales, it reminded me of DuckTales because it's this really kind of quite almost meandering guitar lines, but extremely melodic, and it has that sort of treated whooshy sound, I think, as the producers call it. Enjoyed the whooshy sounds. But I sometimes think that were it not for the whooshy sounds, would people think this is slightly weak songwriting, perhaps, and that you have this layer of...
So it's all in the atmosphere of
the
song.
But, you know, the atmosphere's there, and I think it's very, very strong, so, yeah.
Okay, well, that's Why Won't You Make Up Your Mind by Tame Impala. That's a track from the album Inner Speaker, which is out now. Now, it's time for my choice.
Shaking like a leaf on the desert heat. His daddy's got a bang that's so hard to beat. I bought me a ticket, got a front row seat. I'm checking out the show with a glassy eye. Looking at the sun dancing through the sky. Did he come by UFO? Tricks are full in the book I read. Only man I know that got up from the dead.
That probably requires a degree of explication. That's Jim Sullivan's UFO. It's from 1970 or 1971, I think. It comes from an incredibly obscure album of the same title, which, I mean, I'd never heard of before this. It's about to be reissued, I think, in October. Really weird story behind it. He made this album. It was pressing some very small label in 1970, completely flopped. He's in Easy Rider, apparently. He's in a band that's featured in Easy Rider. Jim Sullivan subsequently vanished. I mean, literally vanished. Nobody knows what happened to him. He went to Mexico and was never seen again. And it is assumed that he died there. This is not like some story. I mean, I've been researching on the internet. And it's a really sad story. I think he was hit very hard by the failure of this album and sort of took to the drink and just ended up in quite a bad way a couple of years later. I get sent a lot of music, and I get sent a lot of reissues. Most of them are quite boring, and I think we've reached a stage where almost all the sort of worthwhile things have been reissued. And it was a Friday afternoon, and I sort of stuck this on in my office, and both me and the guy I share an office with really stopped dead in our tracks by this album. The whole album, I think, is brilliant. People have sort of compared it to sort of James Taylor and those sort of early 70s singer-songwriters. I think there's something a bit kind of weirder and more disconnected and just strange. It really, really has worked its way under my skin, this record, in a way that I sort of wasn't expecting it to. But anyway, your thoughts, please, Rosie.
Well, the thing I like the most about it, me and Ben were discussing this just before we came upstairs, is the kind of juxtaposition, for want of a better word, because I hate that word, between the kind of American sort of frontier country music sound to it. He's almost got a Johnny Cash-ish twinge to his voice, but the production was quite Walker Brothers, we were saying. And then the subject matter, which is kind of, I mean, you know, that...
It's very of its era, the subject.
It's very of its era, exactly. So it feels a little bit hackneyed now, but at the time, you can imagine someone sitting there, maybe not entirely sober, fantasising about UFOs and putting it in a really merry pop song. And I quite like the way that that brushes up against each other.
Yeah. Ben, did you like it?
Yeah, very much. Yeah, I think the Scott Walker thing jumped out at me, where you'll have this rather, almost like a crooning voice that sort of is quite... sort of disarms you, and then you think, oh, this is rather jolly and nice, and he's talking about shaking like a leaf, and there's this like slightly weird acid freak out thing going on underneath, in the same way that Scott Walker would be crooning about utter desperate loneliness, and it would sound rather nice, like when you play your grandma. So he's definitely tapping into, well, I'm not sure whether he'd ever heard Scott Walker, but it seems it's a weird bit of serendipity, I think.
Yeah, the whole album is great. It's being reissued by a label called Lights in the Attic, that have done some really interesting reissues previously. Jim Sullivan's UFO out October 24th on Lights in the Attic. I urge you to give it a listen. It's a really, really interesting record. A few posts from last week's show. Remember, guardian.co.uk/musicweekly is the place to leave messages. Ellie Moose writes about our Carl Hyde of Underworld interview. Maybe if musicians hung on to their day jobs, they wouldn't be obliged to keep churning out soulless slop for us to wallow through. Why are Underworld still making music? Well, what else can they do? Well, they can run a sort of multiple award-winning design agency called Tomato, which they have been doing for many years. But nevertheless, Tar for getting iconica, though. Hopefully Ladies will be seen as bringing more to dubstep than boring vocals and money-spinning crossover tracks. Good point. I think, yes, very good. I was about to say Et Phone Home, but Et Phone Home, obviously. Et Phone Home. I sound like my dad. Who's that, McHammer? Underworld, the soundtrack to a very large part of my youth. One of my favourite memories involves a darkened room full of old friends, a pair of huge Wharfdale speakers, King of Snake, and a luminous stuffed snake, and a bag of Mitsubishi. Deary me. Keep something to yourself. Probably the best live dance act ever. Maybe. Chemical Brothers? Don't know. I can't really recommend them enough. All their music from start to finish. Thank you for some amazing times. I assume he's addressing that to Underworld rather than you and I, Rosie. thank you, E.T. Phone Home. And on our Iconica feature, Miss Wanda posted, I was both excited and slightly dismayed to hear Iconica talk about some people's need to insert the prefix female in front of anything a woman does in dance music. I think it extends beyond dance music to like anything anybody does in any form of music that isn't just being either, I mean, even singer-songwriter, people say female singer-songwriter, and it's like, when did Joni Mitchell's, you know what I mean, debut album come out? Cool people. She said she's excited because the issue was receiving some mainstream attention, depressed because I was saying the same thing 10 years ago. How has this not moved on? I would often get a look of bemusement from promoters when I turned down opportunities to play at female DJ nights, but I simply wanted people to book me because I played good music, not because it was considered some kind of freak show to see a woman behind a pair of decks. How sad that today's youth are still caught in this narrow-minded view. I agree. I think it is really sad. Tough your feedback, everybody. Keep it coming, please. The feature with no name is back. We haven't actually been joined by Michael Hand for once. We're not navigating the darkest recesses of Michael Hand's record collection. But Rosie is here in the hot seat.
Yes.
I'm surprised by this. Who are we remembering this time, Rosie?
We're going to be talking about Fugazi.
Wow. Yeah. I would never have had you down as a Fugazi fan. You are an unknowable woman. but before you tell us more about them, let's hear a track. That was Blueprint by Fugazi. Rosie, why have you brought Fugazi in?
I think that there is a common way to be in love with a band is to grow up with them and to have them be a soundtrack to your formative years. Mm. And that's not at all what happened with Fugazi. I think there was a huge part of American late 80s and 90s underground music that just wasn't part of my discography. Mm. And when I went to university, you know, obviously one of the great things about university is you meet people that are completely different and it's like a big musical exchange. And I remember being played Fugazi and being very dismissive immediately of this just wasn't the kind of music that I was going to be into. And then really falling in love with them. Mm-hmm. Before knowing a little bit, you know, being told a little bit about the kind of band that they were and the scene that they represented, and then going and reading Michael Azarad's Our Band Could Be Your Life.
Have you read that book?
No.
Absolutely.
Amazing book about that culture.
One of the best books about rock and roll I've ever read.
There's the one side of it, which is that hardcore and bands like Black Flag and Minutemen and Minor Threat, I never listened to them.
No.
They weren't something that I was ever into, although I always really enjoyed the notion of the hardcore scene in Washington, D.C. and what it stood for. Mm-hmm. Although you would technically classify Fugazi as post-hardcore because they came... they were, you know, the remnants of Rights of Spring and Minor Threat.
I mean, I think just to give people context, if you don't know about Minor Threat, what Minor Threat stood for, they started Straight Edge, which is a kind of non-drinking, non-smoking...
only having sex with one partner, right?
Yeah. Or not having sex at all.
It's like fidelity. It's about fidelity. It's a kind of respect culture. I know it always sounded so... unbelievably boring, but reading the background to it and reading Ian Mackay's role in it was that it was about, you know, partly he grew up, I guess, looking at, in the late 70s and 80s, looking at these overblown rock bands and feeling quite removed from what they stood for and feeling like he had no interaction or contact with them and that he was excluded from what they represented. And also wanting to create this scene that you had interaction with your fans and you had this community that they were involved in, so it meant you didn't charge more than $5 for a show. They didn't allow moshing and body slamming, and part of that was because they didn't want to exclude young women from moshing who might get, you know, so, you know, there was all these stories about them escorting violent young men from the premises and giving them their $5 back. But also this kind of music and the look that they had, which was skinhead and very aggressive, definitely attracted in that period of history, you know, racists that side of skinhead. So they had to be incredibly vocal about exactly what they stood for.
Yeah.
So they had this kind of humanist civil rights aspect to them. And I think there's something about people being that loud and that brash and screaming in someone's faces, but knowing that they stand for you and they stand for something that you believe in that's incredibly empowering.
We're going to hear a track called Suggestions. Why have you picked that out?
Well, we're going to pick Suggestion because of what I was talking about, which was, Suggestion is... it's the story of harassment as told through a woman's eyes. So basically the suggestion that is imposed on a woman by a male gaze. So to hear a group of men singing that kind of song is kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. Okay, let's have a listen.
Why can't I walk down a street?
God, really? That's real. I haven't heard that for years.
I know.
Really taking me back. Let's talk a little about the sound. Ben, were you at your Fugazi?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I first got into them when The Argument, which is their final album, I guess, 2001 or so, came out. And yeah, again, that starts with this track called Cash Out, which is has this almost, you know, Red Hot Chili Peppers style, like almost like a slap bass line. It's very loping sort of groove. And the lyrics are all about social housing, and it's, which I don't think Red Hot Chili Peppers ever did focused on particularly. But I've almost enjoyed most in recent times about Fugazi is this MP3 that got posted online of there was 40 minutes of stage banter someone had collected. And it's entertaining as any stand-up comedian show. It's really, really excellent. There's some really like sweet little moments in it where. Ian Mackay just says something like he's drinking some Perrier and he's like, I really enjoy Perrier water, does anyone else like it? And some guy at the back goes, it's bubbly. Like, yes, it's nice and bubbly. And then he's also, one of the other guys is wearing some it's called Benday, which is like American deep heat muscle stuff, and he's like, oh, I'm wearing so much Benday today, it really reminds me of my first babysitter. I'm full of erotic nostalgia, and he goes on this like little bit of reverie.
What about the sound appeals to you, Rosie?
Well, likely we see exactly what you were saying before about Minor Threat and about how it felt incredibly white. And the first couple of songs that I heard of Fugazi, they've got this real groove to them, which reminds me a bit of what Gang of Four did. I know that they've been compared to Gang of Four variously, essentially having dub influences. Yeah. Ian MacKay talked a lot about being really into reggae. And so I think you can hear that in what they do. I think the other thing we need to be honest about is they did spawn, you know, they were part of a movement that spawned emo. They're often called the first emo band.
Yeah. Well, Rite of Spring are kind of the first.
Part of that that movement's definitely one of, you know, and right up into My Chemical Romance, and it's just kind of been watered down to this horrible.
We didn't really depoliticised.
Completely depoliticised and just about vague sentiment of teenage loneliness, whereas there's none of the politics. Yeah. And there were all these bands were on major labels, which just completely goes against anything that was on Discord. But I wanted to play the track Sweet and Low because I remember hearing that after getting into them, and it's so different from the rest of their output. I mean, the name of the track is what it sounds like. It's Sweet and Low.
That was Sweet and Low by Fugazi, who are in the feature with No Name this week. What sort of became of Fugazi?
They have been indefinitely on hiatus for about 10 years now. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there was any acrimony or anything like that. As far as I know, Ian MacKay is still incredibly active in the Washington local scene. I don't know if you can see whether you could even remotely still call it hardcore, but he still runs Discord Records, which is never... You know, it's ironic because there was definitely a point where Fugazi would have been signed to a major label so many people were on about them and they never would have done it. And now, you know, you can see all the labels that are incredibly bloated and having to sustain a huge business model are struggling. And because he's never, like most of these independents, probably be okay because he's never sold out. So he's never relied on making loads of money. So he's just still doing Discord. But he did... A soft focus with VBS, which is Vice's TV.
Oh, yeah, which are great. Which are really good. Is that the thing that Ian Suetonius
does? Yeah, exactly.
Does?
And it was kind of an irreverent interview, but there's definitely a sense that there's a cyclical love coming back to them from fans and people wondering where they are. And with reference to all the things that we were talking about what they stood for, and knowing that Ian MacKay is probably still as angry about everything as he was back then, it would be really brilliant if they went back on the road.
Was that something you'd look forward to, Ben?
The very fact that they always did refuse to sell out, and people, you know, this idea of selling out seems, for me, more pertinent than ever before. I mean, some people would say that we're kind of beyond all that now, and that you know, there's nothing to be ashamed of doing, being more kind of entrepreneurial and being like Faithless and having a track with a Fiat advert, or you know, being Kuma Armada and having your record released by Bacardi. But I think that kind of thing drives me absolutely mad, and the one thing I can't stand is feeling like I'm being sold a branded experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that that's a real danger in modern music, and we need people like Ian MacKay to remind us that that is you know, culturally invalid.
Perfect place to end. I think very, very, very good point. Let's wrap up this edition of the feature with No Name with the final Fugazi track. This is Runaway Return. Well, look, that wraps it up for today as well. Thank you very much for coming in, Ben.
Thank you very
lovely,
much.
Lovely to have you. And we hope to see you again. Cheers, as ever, Rosie. Thank you very much.
You're
really
welcome.
Interesting. Never had you down as a Fugazi fan.
There you go.
My thanks, as ever, to producer Pete. I'm Alexis Petridis. See you next time. Bye.